inspiring interviews, provocative people. Get ready. Get bold today with your Emmy-winning host, LeGron Green.
My guest today is Christopher Ryan. He is the author of Sex at Dawn. And I want to have Chris on the show because I want to talk about 50 Shades of Grey. What is it about this that you can see from your sociocultural perspective that's fascinating the public, Chris?
Well, I think that what's happening with this is that that book connects to sort of accumulated reservoir of frustrated female sexual energy.
Oh, okay.
And every once in a while, something will connect with that accumulated energy and we'll get this kind of social phenomenon. I think that what's happened is that in our society, and this has been going on for a long time, and it's starting to relax a little bit, but generally our society says women are not sexual. They really only have sex in order to attract a man, to hold on to a man. Sex is very functional, according to this narrative for women, whereas men are the ones who are looking for sex all the time, right? That's not true. There's no evidence for that in when we look at hunter-gatherers, when we look at human anatomy, when we look at psychosexual research, we find that women are every bit as sexual as men, and they enjoy sex as much or more. They have more capacity than men. But because the narrative is so out of alignment with the reality, and women have been forced into this role, this submissive, sort of demure, passive role for so long that doesn't really fit them at all. When something connects with the truth of female sexuality, even awkwardly and you know, inaccurately, as 50 Shades of Grey does, there's a huge amount of energy there. I mean, if you look, just look at the books that sell the most copies.
Right.
A lot of them, and I don't have the numbers here, but I know a huge volume of the books that are sold are books most of us have never heard of. They're erotic/romantic novels that are sold directly to women. We don't talk about it. It doesn't really get into the mainstream very often. And when it does, it's all scandalous, right? It's like Girls or the, you know, the Sex in the City, you know, there every once in a while there's like a bubble that bursts in the mainstream culture. But meanwhile, all that energy is flowing subterranean, you know.
I love this, how you're outlining it as this repressed female energy that's given some kind of outlet here that wasn't there before.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you think about the sort of themes, the S&M, the, you know, the dominant submission and all that stuff, I haven't read the book, but my understanding is that's mainly what it's about. You know, that also plays into this thing, right? Where a woman who has these sorts of fantasies, what's she saying? She's saying that I want to have these things, but I want to have them in a way that sort of makes it seem like I can't choose not to, like it's against my will, right?
Right.
It's got to be, and that's strangely, counterintuitively, that's a very liberating thing for a lot of women because they've got they're carrying so much shame around being openly sexual because the culture has been telling them and their mothers and their grandmothers and, you know, 50 generations back that any woman who enjoys sex is a slut, any woman who openly invites a sexual contact outside of marriage is this horrible, terrible woman, and she deserves to be shunned and expelled from society and so on. There's a huge amount of shame around this. And so for a woman to say, well, you know, I couldn't help it, I was tied up, and he dominated me, and he made me do it, in a way, that can be a very liberating thing for a woman.
Because I know, Christopher, I was reading, when you went to the doctor, the women used to go to the doctor to have the release of the orgasm, but it was a medical procedure.
Yeah, exactly. This was the most diagnosed disease in the late 19th century in England and the U.S. was hysteria.
Hysteria, yes.
Yeah, and so, and actually this hysteria was the first disease that there's any written record of. It goes back to the ancient Greeks. The very first medical text that we have, I think from Galen, talked about hysteria. And it was a disease throughout the millennia since then. And it only left the medical books, I think, in the 40s or 50s, 1940s or 50s. But the way it was treated was generally vulvar massage, which was when the doctor basically masturbated his female patient to
right,
orgasm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that released the energy, supposedly. I mean,
yeah, right. And of course, you know, as doctors always do, there was all sorts of clinical language around it. And they never called it masturbation. They never called it orgasm. They said, you know, this vulvar massage would provoke a nervous paroxysm. And then the woman would
have orgasm. Right.
Right. And then she'd have to come in for treatment again in a couple of weeks. And, that was the number one reason for women to see doctors.
And, well, rightly so. That's what was happening. And they couldn't get it at home.
You think about it, it's the perfect, you know, disease, in quotes, because no one died from it, but no one got better either. So they had to keep getting treatments. And meanwhile, to keep this running, you had to tell women that they couldn't do this for themselves, right? Because masturbation would make you blind and insane and, you know, destroy your nervous system. All this ridiculous propaganda around sexuality.
Back to 50 Shades of Grey and the whole S&M part of it, or I guess fetishes. Where do fetishes fall in the chronology of human sexual development?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it's one I've been asking a lot of people myself. I recently had Jesse Baring on my podcast, and he wrote a book called Perv, which is sort of a multicultural, historical look at perversions. And he said in his research he had not seen any evidence for what we would call fetishes or perversions among hunter-gatherer people. And I haven't either in my research. I've certainly seen a lot of evidence of group sex and partner swapping and things like that, which some people might consider perversions. But as far as, spanking or obviously there's no latex in hunter-gatherer society.
not that we know of. But
in Brazil, maybe they're tapping the rubber trees. I don't know. The sort of kinky stuff that we associate with perversions, you don't see that generally in hunter-gatherer societies. And in fact, interestingly, in a lot of hunter-gatherer societies, there's not even oral sex, or in some societies, they don't even know what homosexual behavior is. So, and these aren't restrictive societies. These aren't societies where these things would be punished. They're very laid back and relaxed and accepting. But when anthropologists say to them, well, what about when two men get together or two women? The people are just confused.
Interesting. I did not know that, because I always have heard, you know, that homosexuality is something that's pervasive, you know, throughout all cultures. And
exactly. Society. Yeah, me too. It's surprising. But then there are societies in which transgender is completely accepted and not seen as strange.
Right.
So, you know, it comes down a lot to how we define terms and what things mean, you know, because if someone is born in a male body but has a female spirit, then in, you know, the type of society I'm talking about, that person would be considered a woman, you know, even though they have a male body, and she could marry a man and they would adopt children and they would function as just a normal couple. And people would just say, well, she just was born in this male body, but she's a woman. So
much healthier way to look at that, I mean, if you're going to talk about
it. I guess so. And see, that's where you get into weird stuff when you look at anthropological data, because the anthropologist might say to these people, well, what about when two women get together? And the people would be like, well, that doesn't really happen. But what they're thinking is spirit. and the anthropologist is thinking of body.
Right. So the movie's out. You know, everyone's talking about it. People, like, bought tickets, you know, months ahead of time. I did not. I mean, I'm just going to wait and see. But this whole thing you mentioned about the Hunter-Gatherer Society, Chris, they didn't have time to be having all kinds of kinky sex. Like, you had to get the food on the table, whatever you're doing. It's interesting to me.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, hunter-gatherers work less than we do.
Oh, okay.
You got to read my next book. I get into that a lot in the next book called Civilized to Death, which should be coming out the end of this year. On average, hunter-gatherers work from 12 to 20 hours a week. And when I say work, I'm talking about, you know, hunting or, you know, sitting around, you know, chipping arrowheads or whatever, with, you know, chatting with your friends, right? So it's not the kind of work that, like, we have that's sort of separate from the rest of your life, your real life. And so they do have a lot of spare time to hang around, tell stories, and have sex. But I think what happens is that just sort of because sexual expression is free and plentiful, they don't end up developing what we would consider to be unusual expressions. You know what I mean? Like, they don't get into complicated dominance and submission and all these kinds of things. You know, a lot of people who are into being spanked, for example, were spanked as children.
Okay.
Right? Now, if you eliminate that kind of parenting behavior, I wonder how long spanking would continue as a sexual fetish.
Well, it's interesting because, like I said, this whole issue of fetishes, and I love what you said, the thing about perversion. What is perversion? It's always in the eye of the – if beauty is in the eye of the beholder, perversion is also in the eye of the beholder in that sense. And this whole issue of fetishes, like, I know 50 Shades of Grey focuses on the male dominating the woman, but there's also this whole component of men, and you've heard the stereotype of very powerful men who love being dominated by a woman, a dominatrix or what have you. And it's just interesting, why does a powerful man need that? Or why does anyone need that? We don't know where these sexual desires come from. Not just, someplace.
Well, I think a lot of them come from experiences in childhood, and others, you know, come from experiences in the present where there's some sort of imbalance in one's life that we're trying to correct or at least sort of counterweigh in our sexual lives. So it's true, a lot of people, a lot of men who go to dominatrixes tend to be men who are very powerful in that work. And so they go to a dominatrix and they get completely dominated, and that seems to balance things out. I had a woman on my podcast a few months ago who's a humiliatrix.
Humiliatrix, okay.
Right.
But I thought isn't that what dominatrixes do anyway? But this is a specialty of hers.
This is a sort of a subspecialty.
Okay.
So what she does is, you know, a dominatrix might, you know, chain a guy up or make him, you know, get on his hands and knees and, you know, whatever, more of a physical manifestation of domination. Whereas a humiliatrix will insult and, you know, do things that make the man feel humiliated and make him feel fear of being publicly humiliated. So, and she told me some crazy stories, like, guys will send her an email with their bank account numbers, PIN numbers, social security number, everything you could possibly use to blackmail someone. And then her role is to pretend to blackmail them. So if you don't send me $5,000 by tomorrow at noon, I'm going to send, you know, I'm going to, like, give this to Russian hackers. Or they'll send her photographs of themselves in embarrassing positions, and she has to threaten to, like, send this to their wives.
Wow. Chris, I have heard of a lot of things. That's a fact. And I'm pretty unshockable, but I've never heard of that. Wow.
Yeah. Well, the one that really got me was she's got a line or several lines dedicated to guys who get off on being ignored. So they'll call this number and she'll answer the phone and just put it on the table and walk away.
I wish you could see my face now. My mouth is on the floor.
I mean, what a great job.
What a great job. Okay, call me. I will answer the phone and you pay me money. Oh, yeah. I do know, I mean, we won't get too far off of the subject here, but we're talking about 50 Shades of Sex and the underpinnings of the 50 Shades of Grey movement and psychologically, culturally, all these things. But overall, I think this movie is bringing the whole discussion of this that allows us to have podcasts like this, Chris.
Right. And it's cyclical. I don't know if you've seen a documentary called Inside Deep Throat, which was...
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
So you know what I'm talking... I mean, yeah. Wasn't that great? I mean, the same thing sort of happened, right, in the 70s when that came out.
Yes, when that did come out, Linda Lovelace.
Yeah, and you had, like, you know, movie stars lining up on Broadway to go and see it.
To go see porn. And it was a great book that probably came up in your research. I can't remember the author's name, but it made a big impact on me. It was called The Erotic Mind.
Oh, Jack Morin.
Yes. It was one of the most – I read that quite a while ago, and it really opened my eyes.
Yeah, there's a central piece of that book that I often quote to people, which is that passion is the result of desire and an obstacle.
Wow.
You know, if you have desire and an obstacle, you get passion. And so you think of every great love story, Romeo and Juliet, whatever. There's always, like, that attraction, but there's a problem. The families won't let them be together. One of them's already married. Both of them's already married. Whatever it is that stops them from being together, that creates the passion. Then you remove that obstacle and get together, and then the story ends. They lived happily ever after. Well, they probably didn't, because the passion dissipated the minute you took away that obstacle.
Right.
Right, it's like you take away resistance and muscles atrophy. You know, it's everywhere in nature. If you don't exercise, your body just, you know, gets weak and slow. So there has to be that resistance or obstacle of some sort in order to maintain passion, if you want to maintain passion.
Well, everyone's passionate about this movie, 50 Shades of Grey, and we so appreciate you, Chris, for coming on Vogue to talk about this. So thank you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
We want you to pick up Chris's book, Sex at Dawn. And Chris, where can we find you on social media?
My webpage is chrisryanphd.com, and same thing on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere, chrisryanphd.com, or just chrisryanphd is everywhere.
Check them out. Check them out, people. If you like what you've heard today, join the conversation at getboldtoday.com. You can like us. You can tweet us. You can Google Plus us. You can Instagram us, all at getboldtoday. And as always, we close with this. Remember, shift happens right where you are. Be the change and get bold today.